the relationship between the orchestra and Yannick is something to behold, and the sound that our hosts in Ann Arbor are going to be enveloped by too, and the sort of visceral connection to the music making, is something really rare. And we're thrilled, I mean thrilled, to be able to share this gift.
I really enjoyed performing at the Auditorium, and I know how this is an important place in North America to make music, not only historically, but at this moment today.
The role of UMS for more than 100 years in Ann Arbor has been profound and has succeeded in forming a constituency for serious music, in maintaining a presence on the musical scene, and therefore for having contributed to a culture in Ann Arbor of long duration of appreciation for the very finest music in the world.
Welcome to Hill Auditorium on the campus of the University of Michigan. I'm Nancy Deneen.
And I'm Mark Travis. Tonight on Interlochen Public Radio, the Philadelphia Orchestra returns to the University Musical Society and to the city of Ann Arbor for the first time in 24 years.
In that opening clip, we heard the voices of Philadelphia Orchestra President and CEO Matthias Tarnopolsky, Music Director Yannick Nézet-Séguin, and civic leader and former University of Michigan Regent Philip Powers. All were noting their enthusiasm for the program we're about to hear.
Yes, indeed. You know, Nancy, the Philadelphia Orchestra was once a fixture here in Ann Arbor, starting back towards the earliest days of Hill Auditorium, and then continuing for many, many decades.
And there was this short, powerful, bright, charismatic conductor called Eugene Ormandy, who dominated the stage.
Philip Powers, who we heard there, had a front seat to the orchestra and its longtime maestro, Eugene Ormandy, during its residencies here.
Maestro Ormandy used to stay the night either at Inglis House, which was the university's guest house in those days, or with my parents at their house. And so we would have breakfast and sometimes dinner with Ormandy. And I remember him telling the story of being in Inglis House, and the phone rang in his bedroom, and somebody came on the phone saying, "This is the President of the United States calling." And Mr. Ormandy immediately jumped out of bed, stood at attention, and took the call, because he was a formal person. And if the President of the United States is calling me, I am going to stand at full attention and I'm going to talk with him. The other memory that is quite distinct was a party for the Philadelphia at my parents' house. And the first flutist was a very, very distinguished flutist. And I remember him kneeling on his knees in my parents' bedroom and playing solo Debussy while 20 or 30 people stood around and listened. So not only was it people having drinks and nibbles, but various people would pull out an instrument. My parents had a piano in the living room, and there would be music as well. And those parties would go on till 1 or 2 in the morning. And I always wanted to come out of my pajamas and watch these wonderful people.
Tonight, beginning at 7:30, the orchestra will be led by its current music director, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, in a concert presented by the University Musical Society. And he's no stranger to Hill Auditorium.
Of course, I was not around when the orchestra was in residence, basically, every year, the May Festival. But some musicians were there of the orchestra, and we have also musicians who are alumnus from the Michigan University, so they are sharing their excitement at going back to Hill Auditorium. And besides, as I know personally, because I've been there already a few years ago with the Rotterdam Philharmonic, personally conducting.
Tonight's concert will feature the UMS debut of Georgian-born violinist and international superstar Lisa Batyashvili as soloist in the Violin Concerto in D by Tchaikovsky.
And on either side of that, we'll hear two works that celebrate the orchestra's long-standing dedication to contemporary music, beginning with a suite they commissioned from Nico Muhly's new opera, Marnie. Here's the composer with just a few words.
There's a long history of orchestral music being generated by the opera. And indeed, you know, when you write an opera, you are actually writing 2 hours of orchestral music, more or less. So when this idea came up, I thought it would be great. And especially because I had already planned out for the orchestra to have a much more active dramatic role in the piece than in any other stage things I've done before. So this one, to me, felt like a really appropriate thing to do. I don't think I could do it with any of my other staged pieces. So it immediately said, okay, this will be great. In terms of the timing, the way that things get scheduled, I think will be a mystery to me all the days of my life. The tricky thing to remember, too, is that, you know, the order in which things get written and then premiered and then put on a shelf and moved around is actually one of the most thrilling things about being a composer, because you write this stuff and then, you know, it undergoes 3 months of copying and editorial work and then premieres, and then a year later you come back to it and it's sort of like seeing a picture of yourself from a happier time.
Tonight's concert will conclude with music of Rachmaninoff, a composer with whom the orchestra had a close association for many years. We'll hear the last work he ever penned, the Symphonic Dances, dedicated to Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
And it's worth noting, Nancy, that Rachmaninoff was also well acquainted with Hill Auditorium. He gave a recital here in 1934, which is impressive all by itself, right? Hill Auditorium living up to its reputation as the Carnegie Hall of the Midwest. But I love that the history books have also noted what he ate after the concert.
What he ate?
Yes. Are you ready? Creamed chicken in patty shells. Rachmaninoff's culinary tastes are also noted when it comes to his famous Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini, a work that was actually given its premiere that same year by Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra, with Rachmaninoff himself taking the piano part. Well, one of the variations, the finale of the piece, in fact, came to be known as the Creme de Menthe variation. Rachmaninoff was normally a teetotaler, but apparently even he found parts of his Rhapsody so difficult that he decided he perhaps could use a little liquid courage. Here now is Daniil Trifonov performing that music in a recent recording with the Philadelphia Orchestra, led by its music director, Yannick Nézet-Séguin.
Isn't the only variation in that piece to have a story, Mark. Rachmaninoff also included part of the Dies Irae, or the Day of Wrath, chant into the score. We actually heard it loud and clear at the end of the finale. Rachmaninoff also incorporates it in a few other parts of the score. Just so you recognize it when you hear it, here's the original chant.
Dies Irae, Dies Irae. Solvet secum in favilla, teste David cum sibilla.
And here Here's how it's treated in the seventh variation of the Rhapsody. And you'll also want to listen for that same Dies Irae motif when we hear Yannick Nézet-Séguin conduct the composer's symphonic dances later tonight.
This is Live from Hill on Interlaken Public Radio. I'm Mark Travis. And in just a little while, we will indeed hear Yannick Nézet-Séguin lead the Philadelphia Orchestra from the University Musical Society at Hill Auditorium for the first time since 1994.
The orchestra was well known in Ann Arbor in the 20th century as part of the May Festival, a mainstay of cultural life here. And beginning in the 1930s, the event became synonymous with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Peter Payette has this look at the history of the May Festival.
David Booth says a lot of the landmarks he remembers in Ann Arbor are gone since his last visit. He started playing violin with the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1973, and when he'd come to May Festival, he liked to go to Liberty Music Shop.
It was one of the most wonderful, wonderful classical music shops that I still to this day have encountered in the United States. It was absolutely amazing.
In those days, the Philadelphia Orchestra would spend most of a week in Ann Arbor, and the festival included some of the biggest names in music, like Van Cliburn, Aaron Copland, and Vladimir Horowitz.
Horowitz was really very special because, for one thing, he's one of my absolute gods of gods. He really loved being at Ann Arbor. I know that. I met him. Actually, he would go almost every night to a disco called the Rubaiyat that was there. And he was very, very friendly.
This was 1978. Horowitz had just started playing with orchestras again after a 25-year break. He'd returned to Carnegie Hall to perform Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto. And a few months later, he played it in Hill Auditorium. The May Festival had been running for more than 80 years when Horowitz performed. It started in 1894. That was the year the Boston Festival Orchestra agreed to come to Ann Arbor only if they could play three shows, not one. A music professor named Albertus Stanley had the idea of calling the concert series the first annual May Festival. It was advertised across Michigan, and Ken Fisher, former director of the University Musical Society, says it was an instant hit.
In fact, the first May Festival in 1994, the fire marshal had to be called in to the new to then University Hall. It was, people were just hanging from the ceiling. And it was, the fire marshal then said, "You guys better do something. This cannot continue." And that was the first discussion then among the regents of the university and the University Musical Society. Maybe we need a bigger hall.
20 years later, Hill Auditorium was built, still one of the largest concert halls in the U.S. One of the first orchestras to play in Hill was Philadelphia. That was 1913. They returned in 1936 and became a fixture at the May Festival.
From the Hill Auditorium on the campus of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan, we bring you a program by the Philadelphia Orchestra under the direction of the orchestra's permanent conductor, Eugene Ormandy.
Eugene Ormandy conducted the orchestra almost every year they appeared for nearly half a century. He became well acquainted with Ann Arbor. He attended parties and dinners. He made Hail to the Victors the encore of the final show every year. He had his musicians work with students and said that was important.
The important role of an artist always is to be the carrier, the continued carrier, the infected carrier of knowledge and tradition in its best sense, to arouse that virus of curiosity in all the young people.
Ormandy and his orchestra would have been familiar to anyone with any interest in classical music. They made hundreds of recordings in those days. Greg Powell was a freshman at University of Michigan in 1968. As a kid, he says his parents would play records to wind him down at night.
And some of their favorite records were Eugene Ormandy conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra. And so I grew up with that love and reverence for that orchestra and that conductor. So I came to Ann Arbor to go to school, and wow, they come here for a week every year. How cool is that?
Greg was part of another fixture at the May Festival, the Choral Union, which would perform with the orchestra. He sang in Mahler's Second Symphony in 1970.
And the chorus doesn't do anything the first four movements. And then halfway through the fifth movement, we'd stand up and sing the end of the piece. And it's absolutely hair-raising, spine-chilling, the end of that symphony.
Greg Powell says that concert changed his life. His parents had grown up in the Depression and insisted that he become an engineer. After performing Mahler, he rejected that plan.
I just knew I couldn't devote myself to engineering like I could to music.
The May Festival began to falter in the 1980s. Ormandy retired, and one of his successors, Ricardo Muti, ended Philadelphia's relationship with Ann Arbor. Ken Fisher says the University Musical Society couldn't find a new partner like the one they had.
You can imagine how wonderful that is for a presenter like us to be able to pick up the phone and call the Eugene Ormandy and say, what are we going to do next year, and have it all work out within several weeks.
Fisher says Ricardo Muti might not have understood the deep relationship between Ann Arbor and the Philadelphia Orchestra. He says he bumped into the conductor years later and asked him about the May Festival.
And I said, you know, I wasn't here at the time, but I'd be interested in what you have to say about that. And he looked at me and he said, you know, Ken, I was a bit younger back then. And, you know, I made that decision that we would not be coming back to Ann Arbor. But had I spent a little more time learning about the nature of the relationship, the decision might have been different. He didn't say it would be different. He said it may be different.
That story was produced by Interlochen Public Radio's executive director, Peter Payette.
Nancy, I had the chance to speak with Richard Harlow, a longtime cellist with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He's an alumnus of Interlochen and of the University of Michigan, actually, and he was among the people who tried to help Ricardo Muti better understand Ann Arbor and its culture.
I actually went to him and welcomed him to, this is where I grew up. This is where I went to school. I grew up 30 miles from here. Welcome to my home. And, you know, he told me after that, too, he had a great respect for the Ann Arbor audience. He said they're very educated. And he was a tough conductor to please. And if the audience ever made any kind of disruption or noise or anything, he reacted to it. But he really loved the Ann Arbor audience.
This is Live from Hill. Coming up, Yannick Nezet-Séguin conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra performing music of Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, and a new work from Nico Muhly, a suite from his opera, Marnie. I'm Nancy Dineen.
And I'm Mark Travis. Eugene Ormandy once praised the May Festival for not becoming commercial and having, quote, affectionate respect for the making of music. He said the concerts here were special.
I know that when I was asked to come here, I always try to think of something, not that we ordinarily play all the time in the repertoire, but something that is fresh enough and musically valid to be an event for us, something that is it gives a sense of excitement to the performer, because unless the performers are excited, the audience will never be.
In the 1960s, Gustav Mahler fit that bill. When Carl Grapentine began as a student at U of M, he'd never heard of Mahler. But he still remembers that performance of Mahler's Symphony No. 2 almost 50 years ago.
And there is this gorgeous oboe solo at the beginning of the movement, which is only about 5 minutes long. It's a mezzo-soprano solo. And I remember John Delancey playing it, and he starts coming down the scale, and you think it's going to resolve, and instead it goes back up and does a little turn, and all without a breath, and I'm out of breath sitting here just thinking about it. It was just so gorgeous. I was in the first balcony in Hill, and my brother was singing in the chorus for the Mahler second, but we caught each other's gaze. I just sort of bit my neck like, oh, is that gorgeous? And he said yes, you know, from across the auditorium.
For many years, Carl Grapentine was a music host on WFMT in Chicago, and he is still the voice of Michigan Stadium. He recently moved back to Ann Arbor, but unfortunately couldn't join us at the concert tonight. But Carl, wherever you are, we wish you good health and good music.
Take a moment and just imagine, whether you've ever been a musician or not, imagine how you'd feel at a very young age, early to mid-20s, if you landed a position at the top, and I mean the very top, of your field. If you were a CEO or a celebrated visual artist, perhaps an Oscar-winning actor or an elite player in professional sports, say hockey or football. Mark, you and I got to ask three of the younger members of the Philadelphia Orchestra about the moment they each found out that they were in.
Really, it didn't sink in. It hasn't really sunk in yet.
I'm very lucky to join this orchestra, and that was just a wonderful feeling.
Incredibly surreal, but like exciting at the same time.
And that was such a touching moment, Nancy, because while we can spend time, as we have been, talking about the legacy of the Philadelphia Orchestra and of the May Festival and of grand maestros like Eugene Ormandy, the Philadelphia Orchestra is still one of today's most exciting, most vibrant orchestras in the country, if not in the entire world. And part of the driving force behind that is this youthful energy that begins with these three young people with whom we visited. So there we heard the voices of Olivia Staten and Patrick Williams, who are each starting their first season with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And we also heard Carol Jantsch remembering her start with the group in 2006. Carol landed the principal tuba position even before she graduated from the University of Michigan. She did go back for her degree.
Olivia Staten, the person who said, It still hasn't sunk in yet. Remember that? Mm-hmm. She has a nerve-wracking story about learning that she would be the newest member of the flute section.
It was the last concert of my second trial week, and it was during intermission. And the second half was Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, which is a really exciting and involved second flute part. So it was intermission, and I was just, you know, getting myself mentally prepared for the second half. And Yannick called me into his office or his dressing room, and he told me right before the second half of the concert. So, yeah, I was, you know, really trying hard to focus during that second half. So I guess the moment I found out was, I mean, I started crying, if I'm being honest. Yeah, I still can't really believe that I get to do what I love for my job.
Now, back in 2006, when Carol Jansch heard about winning her position, principal tuba, in the Philadelphia Orchestra, there was some blurry thinking about just who to share that news with first.
I think the night of the audition, I want to say I called my parents first, but I might have called Fritz Kenzig first, my tuba teacher in Michigan. Let's say I called my parents first.
You know, Nancy, an orchestra is a tapestry of vastly different people with different experiences and personalities, and everyone has their own approach to figuring out that important balance between life and making music on a high level. There's even variation among the three young players that we visited with. Patrick Williams, for instance, sees value in a digital presence, but notes that it's not the end all.
Well, I do have a website and I do a little bit on social media, but for me, it's the most important thing is about relationships and building healthy friendships with my colleagues. And that carries out into the music world. It's a relatively small sphere, and I think that it's just very important to have good relationships, whether you do it via online services or just keeping in touch with people or when you're performing. Just having a good rapport with people is very important.
And Carol Jansch realizes the convenience and effectiveness of using the internet in her professional life.
I think as a modern musician, social media certainly has a huge place for what we do. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, one of the best ways to advertise your concerts and get people to come.
So Carol has a webpage, social media, and even a SoundCloud page featuring another ensemble she's in. It's a good reminder that while the orchestra functions as a unit, the individuals who make up the organization, well, they have other things going on too. Mm-hmm. And their influence even reaches into other communities and other genres. Mark, Carol told us about her group. It's called Tubular. And it all began with connections made right here in Ann Arbor. The group has a sense of humor, and they call themselves the world's best tuba cover band.
I think a sense of humor is necessary for a band of this kind.
So it's me and my friends from college playing tubas and drum set together and doing bad vocals, but mostly just having a good time. We play a lot of cover music from Led Zeppelin and Lady Gaga to Britney Spears to Bruno Mars to the Beatles.
And even apparently, and this is for my kids, some Taylor Swift.
By the way, Tubular is making an appearance this weekend in Ann Arbor. They're performing tomorrow night at the Canterbury House on East Huron Street. you've been hearing the group Tubular, fronted by Carol Yonch, principal tuba of the Philadelphia Orchestra, a U of M graduate and an alumna of Interlaken Center for the Arts. This is Classical IPR. I'm Nancy Dineen.